Good evening. I think good evening. Can you hear me? Okay. Welcome to Venerable Robina's weekend workshop on how to enjoy death. Surprisingly, not so many people are here to hear about death. Doesn't scare me, but anyway. Let me just fill you in on a couple of things. If you're not familiar with Venerable Robina, she has been a nun for a little bit more than 35 years. She's a student of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's the spiritual director of our center and our parent organization. She has a very sharp, incisive, powerful, challenging, sometimes scary manner of teaching, but it's really helpful to help us challenge our own assumptions. So welcome to the ride. A couple of little announcements. When she enters the Gompa, we stand out of respect for the teacher and the teachings. And then at Kadampa Center, a little bit different from normal tradition, Geshe-la, at his request, when he prostrates, we prostrate with him. But it's traditional and to prostrate after the teacher has taken her seat. So we'll be doing that tonight. If anybody is unfamiliar with or uncomfortable with prostrations, you don't need to do them. You can go ahead and sit. Again, the prostration is just a sign of respect. I want to let you know about a couple of pilgrimages and retreat in Asia that Robina will be leading. Excuse me. Forgot to have all my teaching aids with me. She's leading a 5-day retreat at Borobudur, which is a 9th century Buddhist temple in Indonesia. That's in June 24 to 28. And in October and November, she's leading a 3 to 4 week pilgrimage in India and Nepal. You go to all the amazing Buddhist holy sites, the place where the Buddha was born, where he would spend time in retreat with his disciples, where he passed, in Rajgir, where he gave the teaching on emptiness, and in Bodh Gaya, where he was enlightened. It's really an amazing opportunity. Louise has been, Nikki has been, I've been, Patrick has been. It's a life-changing experience. So if you're interested in doing it, these postcards are out in the lobby, and you can get information from them. Venerable Robina will teach for a while, and then she'll open the floor to questions. We are streaming and recording the teachings, so if you do ask a question, there will be someone who will hand you a microphone. Please be sure to use it. Hold it close to your mouth, just like I'm doing. I know it's hard, but if you don't, you can't hear anything. So please use the microphone. Don't forget to mute your phones. For this weekend, Venerable Robina has provided some course notes, which we got printed for you, and we have them available in the bookstore, and we're asking a suggested donation of $10 to cover our costs. And will you please put your shoes on the shoe shelf? Keep Wendy happy. Put your shoes on the shoe shelf. And tomorrow it will be a teaching all day, starting at 10, ending at 4:30. We'll take a lunch break. Bring a bag lunch. Venerable Robina really encourages us when we're having weekend workshops like this to stay here during the break, get together, and talk about what we've been hearing. It really helps. As she said, quoting, I don't remember who, but learning is 10% hearing and studying and reading and 90% debate. So discussion is very helpful. And then we gather our questions, and she wants to hear those in the afternoon. Sunday morning, she'll be teaching our regular Sunday morning teachings, but then in the afternoon we'll start again at 1:30. Kadampa Center, will you two boys behave? I'm channeling my inner teacher. Kadampa Center is in our 25th year of existence. We started really tiny, and we've grown, and we have grown because of, not in spite of, a policy that we've long held that we do not charge for the Dharma. These teachings are so precious and so important. We never want money to be an obstacle for anyone to hear them. However, we do have expenses, so we would happily welcome any donation that anyone is inclined to give. There's a donation box right outside the Gampa. There's one right inside the door on Jill's desk, and there is a credit card machine in the bookstore. So thank you for any generosity you extend toward us, and she will be here soon, and have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
You know, whether you're just going to be here today for this or the whole weekend, we think we're going to listen to these viewpoints, these explanations coming from the Buddha, coming through the filter of our Tibetan Buddhist tradition, in particular through the teachings of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, of the Gelugpa tradition, about Buddha's teachings about impermanence, about death, the death process, in particular from the Vajrayana, and then the way to prepare ourselves for death so that we can help others prepare for death. The most precious gift we can give others, particularly this, but in the long term, so that we can continue to work on our path, so we can develop, become a Buddha, so we can be a genuine benefit for others for as long as time exists. Thinking like this. And if it's curiosity, because you haven't heard this stuff before, then listen with an open mind to think maybe there's some tools here I could use to help me know how to help my grandma die, my mummy die, my pussycat die, myself to die, so I can, from the Buddhist perspective at least, so I can get another decent human rebirth, so they can get a decent human rebirth, so they can keep on moving, you know, themselves on their spiritual path. Okay. Sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho badu dagni kyabsu chi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la jangcho badu dagni kyabsu chi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye charang Soke chognam la, jangcho badu dagni kyabsu chi, dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki, drola penche sangye drupa shog. You got just, where are your course notes? Donna, where are their course notes? They got them?
Some.
You got the course notes? Oh, okay, good. All right. Okay, good, good. You all should get them. Yeah, they're all out there, right? They can get them?
Yeah.
Good, fantastic. Okay. Oh, I see you spent money on the colour cover. You could have done black and white. It would have been cheaper. That's what I said to you in the email. Don't have to do colour. I was trying to save you money.
I was a little bit dense that day.
Oh, darling. Then I would have done the words gold because they look cuter. I put the words back purposely. Never mind. I'll do them. Disappointing. Never mind. I love to complain. I'm such a good complainer, I tell you. I'm the best complainer in the world. Okay. Lama Zopa Rinpoche's book out, some excerpts from that book, which is out there also in this book, a bunch of things. It started years ago, actually, in France. This is more than 10 years ago now. Lama Zopa Rinpoche was teaching another course, and then one of his old students, I think I mentioned this in passing before, one of his old students came up and said, her father died suddenly, and she didn't know what to do. So, I think he was probably surprised, you know, because here we all are, if we've been Buddhists for a few years, believe me, we all know about impermanence and death. Buddha tells us about it from day one, you know, you can't escape. And because we take the view of reincarnation, then death comes into it, and you just learn about it in daily life. It's not something you live in total denial of. But nevertheless, I think it seems, and this is my own experience, we all know about, yeah, this, that, and we all know about the 8 stages of death, we all know about this, blah, blah, blah. But when it comes to it, if we haven't really educated ourselves properly about really what it means and really the death process and how to help others, we do live in denial of it because we don't want to think about death. So when somebody does die, especially if they're close, we do say, I didn't know what to do. We get a shock, you know. So this is actually education. This book of Rinpoche's came out of that. And it's actually, it's basically a manual. The first part of it is all basic teachings about impermanence, why there's so much fear at death, why attachment's the main cause of suffering at death, the practical teachings about it, and how to think about reincarnation, these kind of things. And then the main part of the book, there's two-thirds of the book at the end is all the practices. That's the majority of the book. All the practices, masses of them, which Rinpoche recommends at different stages in this process. But the main part of Rinpoche's actual teachings, which is probably only 150 pages of the 450, is this first about death and then what to do when, basically. What to do the months and weeks before, because this is talking about a gradual death, you know. What to do the hours before, what to do at the time the breath stops, what to do the hours after, what to do the days after, and then the weeks after. So it's a whole manual of what to do when, you know. And of course, like anything, it needs education. You just can't think, well, oh, yeah, I'm a Buddhist, I know what to do at the time. No, because we freak out. Because we don't like to think about death. And especially, it'll be loved ones who die. We're so overwhelmed by the emotional stuff and worried about things and don't know what to do, blah, 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 you know. So it really is important education. So this book, it was started back then and then it got stopped and then it started again a few years ago and I happened to be the person who was editing it. Which means putting together Rinpoche's teachings. He just leaves this to his students, you know. The book had to be created, basically. And So for myself personally, it was really powerful to have to do this. Because when you edit a person's teachings, you've got to be really clear you know what you're talking about, you know. And this stuff that we often think about, oh yeah, I've done all this and we know about this and know about that. When you really have to edit it and choose from Rinpoche's many, many teachings over the last 40 years exactly what to put in, you really got to think twice, you know. And it really shocked me at how deep you have to go and therefore how I could see that my knowledge was quite superficial. So it was really an incredibly fortunate experience for me, and I've got much enthusiasm for it now, I tell you. Many of the centres we're doing courses on this, you know, last year we had booked a 10-day retreat on this topic at Kopan Monastery, and I think there were 60 people booked. And then the earthquakes came and 50 people cancelled. But 10 people turned up, it was very brave of them, so we still did it, and we're doing another one again this year. So it's a really good thing to talk about, and I really have such enthusiasm for it, you know. Certain things for me, kind of, even though I've been a Buddhist for a long time, have become kind of clear. Because it takes time. And the reason is because we have such addiction to feel we're permanent. You know, to feel we're permanent. Even though we know perfectly well we're going to die, you know. We don't want to think about it. So there's different things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about just how to live our life so that we are prepared for death, because you can't just wait till death. And then we're going to talk about the process, you understand, the process, and then the various things, what to do when. This is the point. And then at the time, also it's very interesting, because the typical way that Lama Zopa teaches, like all the lamas, once a person stopped breathing, the traditional one is to leave the body for 3 days. Well, that's really unusual in the West. Some people do it, but it's very, it's most unusual that people would do this. Even the Buddhists. And because why? Because most people don't die at home, you know? One of my friends, Yeshi Kadro, one of the nuns of this organization, who ran for many, many years Karuna Hospice, a palliative care service in Brisbane in Australia, that really is well known around the country, and they get government funding, and they have, you know, hundreds of volunteers who go around taking care of the dying and the families. It's not just for Buddhists, even though it's a Buddhist organization, and they'd be really well respected. I mean, the nuns there said that the vast majority of people they deal with do not die at home. So the ideal scenario is to leave the body for the 3 days. So then that's the first. So when we talk about what to do once the person's passed away, there's these, like, what to do if the person dies at home. What to do if your loved one dies in a hospital or a hospice. Well, you maybe have half an hour if you're lucky, you know, before they take the body. And this is, you've got to really know what you're doing and really know what your rights are. And this is often what happens, you know. The hospital takes over, they do their job, but that, you know, we have to know what our rights are. What to do if your loved one dies suddenly. This is a big drama, you know, because we really freak out then. And indeed, a really important piece is what to do if your loved one wants to give their organs. And there's something very interesting about that, which we'll talk about. And then, of course, if your loved one is a high yogi, what to do when your loved one dies if he's in meditation? Well, the simple thing is leave them alone. They know what they're doing. Back off. Let them be, you know. It was a bit more than that, but it's very interesting. So these are some scenarios. And then, of course, a lot of the practices Rinpoche recommends, which is typical for the Tibetan Buddhist, is what to do once the mind has left the body and they're buried. There's so many things we can do to help our loved one's consciousness, even after it's left the body, to help change the karma. You know, Rinpoche talks like this with great optimism. So we'll go through all of this over the weekend, okay? So, of course, the starting point has to be to live our lives in the context of impermanence. And as we all know, if we're Tibetan Buddhists, we learn the Lam Rim, and junior school grade 1 entry level is Lord Buddha's teachings about impermanence. And this is a huge topic in Buddhism. There's masses of it covered in the Buddhist literature. And, of course, Lord Buddha talks about impermanence in terms of subtle impermanence and gross impermanence. And, of course, the real meaning of impermanence is this one so-called subtle impermanence, which is actually the main meditation for the great Theravadan meditators. You know? And even in meditation, this can easily be confused with emptiness. In fact, in the different Buddhist views, when you study Buddhist tenets, you know, in one level of the views, subtle impermanence is actually considered to be gross selflessness for another school. There's kind of confusion. It can be easily be confused. And also meditating on subtle impermanence, which is really quite advanced, is a marvelous stepping stone to begin to understand emptiness, you know? Did I say impermanence? I said emptiness, didn't I? Okay, yeah. So, it's really important though. But so, Atisha, in his little Lam Rim text called Lamp that guides us on our path, that Lama Tsongkhapa in the 14th century, our like patron saint, you know. There he is with his little hat on, this one, middle, with his two main boys, holy boys. He took this as the basis of his structure of the teachings called the Lam Rim, as we all know, this gradual path, this course to Buddhahood. So the very first one, Atisha, therefore Tsongkhapa gets us to think about, forget about subtle impermanence. That's too la-di-da, you know. He gets us right between the eyeballs. That is gross impermanence, and not even just gross impermanence, but the impermanence of this person, and guess what that is? That's called death. So he's got a kind of an agenda. It's learning about impermanence, no question, it leads us into the path. But his real agenda is to give us a wake-up call. That's why he gets us to think about my own death. Not death out there, someone else, but really to get us to come to terms with the fact that I will die. So as we all know, he talks about it in terms of three points, you know. The very first one is to think about, to contemplate, to think about, basically, think about the fact that death is definite. Now, we'll hear that and we'll go, yeah, okay, mate, I know that. Give me something more interesting, please. But we might know it intellectually, but absolutely what Buddha's pointing out, and the more we think about it, we're going to see it's true. We actually live in, even though intellectually we know it's true, I'm going to die, we would never say to anybody, I'm not going to die. We'd be embarrassed. How stupid. But if we look at the way we live our lives, it's as if we believe we will not die. So we've got to really puncture that misconception, you know. So the first point is that one. So how do you do that? You can do it formally in your cushion, no doubt, but the real application is every day. And let's face it, because of internet and news and such visibility of the world, first of all, news is obsessed with death. And then everywhere you turn, ants, mosquitoes, dogs, people dying all the time. It's pretty evident to us that death is definite. We can see so many examples, and that's the way to think, you know. But the point is this, we know it's definite, but the fact is, it won't come home to us. We won't get the learning from it, because we've got to think, what's the learning in this? We won't get the learning until we go, that'll be me. That's the most powerful thing we can do. We can think about death till the cows come home. We all know people die. We can talk about the wars and the dramas and these poor people and this and that and the animals and the insects, but it doesn't touch us, because most of the people are strangers. We hardly even notice, you know. It's too objective, too abstract. Then it gets a bit closer to home, isn't it, when it's our loved ones. And it really touches us then. But you know what? We still don't get the point. Until we say, when we see our beloved dying, our mummy dying of cancer, our brother, our beloved best wife, and our child, our baby, can be so utterly moving. And that's grief and loss, but that's not the learning here. Until we say, when we look at that dead baby, that dead mummy, that dead auntie, that dead sister, dead cat, until we say, oh my God, that will be me, we won't get the learning. It'll never come home to us. And this is so profound. Just saying that, it's like, that's the wake-up call, because that's the point. that Lama Tsongkhapa was trying to get us to see. It's easier to see it in the world. All the time. I mean, you lived in some little village, you know, 1,000 years ago, 500 in Tibet. You'd never heard of anybody else's death unless they're right in front of you. But here we're here all day flooded by death, you know, to the point where we're immune to it. But until we bring it to ourselves, and this is the point of it, get the wake-up call. Death is definite. That'll be me. There's that wonderful text that Pabongka wrote, Pabongka Rinpoche, initially translated as heart spoon. You know? And many of those verses, the little refrain is, this will happen to me. You know, this will happen to me, or this will be me, whatever it is. That is when it gets at home. So then what do we do? Then what? Get scared? Which is what we tend to think. No, get to the next one. Well, yeah, get scared. But the next one should scare the life out of us. Death is definite, which feels comfortable, definite. But it's kind of, what does that mean? Way off in the distance, somewhere over there, you still feel safe, you know? As Lama Tsongkhapa says, we divide the world into living people and dying people. What a farce. As Rinpoche says, living people die before dying people all the time. But you look at the concepts we've made up. It's a concept, a dying person. You don't even talk about dying people. Oh, they're dying. Well, it's not even a real person if they're dying, are they? They haven't got a life, have they? You speak in hushed terms. You don't ask them about how they feel. What's the weather like? What are you doing next week? We don't say that because they're dying people. But excuse me. It's like a joke. What Rinpoche says is completely true. You just do a bit of market research. Of course, we don't like this kind of market research. A person who believes they're in the category called living people, they die all the time before dying people. It's simply a truth. But we believe in these ridiculous labels, you know. And who likes to talk about dying people? Even like they're weird, there's like a special race of people, dying people. They don't really exist because they're not really living. They haven't got a life, have they? You think about it. What do you mean by a dying person? Oh, she's dying. Wow. I remember reading in Time magazine one time about death and everything. And this one fellow who was a CEO of some big company, and he got MS. He's going to die slowly, right? I mean, guess what? We're all dying slowly. But he knew he was going to die slowly. We just don't realize, that's all. Because we think we're living people. And he said, well, he wasn't going to tell anybody. And then he thought he'd better tell his board of directors. Well, they fired him in a week. Who wants a dying person running your organization? How revolting. This is how we think, isn't it? But it's what a joke. Remember his point. Living people die before dying people all the time, you know. And if you did your market research, you'd be shocked at the truth of that, you know. These concepts, we make these up, you know. We make these stories up and then we plant them on top of the people. There's a living person, there's a dying person. And this hubris we have. We see about dying people, even we see the auntie, we hear about the sister got cancer, we kind of feel this kind of, phew, it's not me. Phew, what a relief, you know. I'm okay, I'm a living person. We leave the hospital, kind of can breathe freely now because I'm back in the living world. I'm a real person. And leave the poor dying people in the hospital. We think this way. But the point is, it's complete nonsense. It's complete a joke. Until the point of these 3 points about death is definite, time of death is uncertain, and we're going to get to the next point, because the time of death is uncertain. That's the point of the second one. You have absolutely no idea when you're going to die. This should scare the life out of us. And this is one we cannot bear to even begin to contemplate. Even if we do contemplate it, we can't believe it. So what this one is it is true you are dying. It is true death is definite. It is true we're heading towards death. But the way we feel, this feeling of permanence. You know, a really good analogy, like, you know, I live at Robbie's house when I'm here. 7 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, depending on the traffic, right? But even though people go different routes, as I've got used to it, you think of this, a really powerful point. As soon as I leave here, there's a real feeling, isn't there, of moving away from Kadampa Center towards my home, in this case, Robbie's house. And as you keep driving, I see the different signposts, I see the indicators, and there's this vivid feeling of being 5 minutes away from Kadampa, 5 minutes closer to Robbie's. So Robbie's is getting closer and closer and closer, and Kadampa Center is getting further away. That's a very vivid feeling, isn't it? Now, we should live our life like that. But we don't feel that because we believe I'm permanent, and we wake up each day, even though you look in the mirror and you can see you've got the double chins and the wrinkles. You know you're heading to death. We still don't want to know about it. We live in denial of that horrifying thought. We know we're getting closer to death. It's a simple way to say it, but it sounds so depressing to talk this way. one day closer to death. It's a literal fact. But it sounds, oh, we can't bear to think such a depressing thought, you know. But it's a fact. And all Buddha's doing is trying to get us to see facts. His main deal, we mentioned this before, we talked about emptiness. Buddha's whole way of framing all of Buddha's teachings is that these neuroses in our mind, these delusions, their main job is to lie to us. So therefore there's this massive disconnect between facts and how we see things. And that is the source of our suffering. This is Buddha's view, and this is his own experience. We need to see the truth of this. He's not making something up. Don't believe it. That's what suffering is. The delusions are what cause suffering, and the delusions cause us to have a disconnect between how I see things and the way things in fact are. This is Buddha's view, which is why when we've given up delusions all the way down to subtle ignorance, there is no longer any fear. There is only bliss. So fascinating. So, the second one, like I said, should scare the life out of us. But doesn't, because we're so immune to the truth, you know. Because we're so living in the lie of I'm a permanent living person. So the vivid feeling to get is one day closer to death. Every time you wake up, it's one day closer to death. It's fact. It's not fearful, it's a fact. It's a fact. You know, Rinpoche says, best to think I will die today. Best, for the biggest wake-up call. We haven't got to the real... The action point is number three. We haven't got to there yet. The action point, the conclusion from these three is the third point. We'll get to it in a minute. The fact is, I have no idea. You can speculate. You know, I'm more likely... I can be more certain now that I'm 71 or whatever about when I'll die than when I was 20. You know, maybe a couple more, a few more years left, you know. And who wants to be 100 anyway? So I don't want 30 years, you know? Unless I'm super fit. No, I couldn't want... I don't think I want 30 years. Can you imagine me coming back in 30 years' time? Hello, Romina, with my walking stick. Meeting all your grandchildren. All your old friends. I knew your grandmother. She's dead 20 years ago. I don't think so. I can't imagine it. Who knows? Anyway.
You're invited.
Anyway, you understand my point. So the thing is to get this vivid feel. We've got to check. And you see, this is what's fascinating too with Buddha's view. The way we feel feelings, okay, is informed by the viewpoints deep down. So that because we've got this viewpoint deep down that I'm permanent, then we feel permanent. Like I feel like a living person. Because and why? I'm not that old yet. Well, we think it's changing, isn't it? I am definitely in the old category. I can't say middle age anymore. I'm not sick. And I feel good. We even say, oh, I feel so alive. I feel like death. Isn't it? That's how we talk, isn't it? It's hilarious. As if that's got to anything with the price of fish. Zero. But we believe our feelings, isn't it? We live in this fantasy of what our feelings tell us. I mean, we're embarrassingly stupid. We should be blushing with shame for our stupidity. But as I say it, I will die today. I don't believe it for one second. Not one second. I believe with a billion percent scientific certainty that I will be here tomorrow seeing you. Is that not how we all feel? So it shows how deep the lie is. And this is a lie that's evident. Emptiness, you've got to squeeze your brain, as Lama Yeshe puts it, and you really can't see the truth of it for a while, intellectually. But this one, so easy. But look how profound, primordial the misconception is, the lie is, the fear, the denial, you know. And it's because of attachment. So attachment, like I keep talking, and we're going to talk about this a lot more when it comes to the death process, you know, one of its functions, and this function here, is the one of clinging like vampires, in this case, to me and my body and my life. This is the reason, in this little chapter in Rinpoche's book, that attachment at the time of death is the reason there is so much fear, and the reason in life that we live in denial. So because we're so attached, so desperately craving to be me and have mine, so that on top of that we've imposed this fantasy of permanence. And I wonder if permanence comes first. I'm never quite sure. Think about that one. Very fascinating. And even whatever the status is, we'd see it as permanent. So if you, this is the point. When you're miserable, and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, that's depression, isn't it? And that's why we kill ourselves. Because we can't see any point in life. Because we think it's permanent. When everything's happy and you finally found happiness, now you lock it up and now you've got happiness for eternity. You believe that's permanent. So whatever the status is, whatever it is, good or bad, we believe is permanent. It's a deep, deep, deep delusion in our minds that we fall into a trap of every second. So to unpack this lie is not that easy, even though it's a simple one, relatively. And whatever the status is, we believe that's permanent. I mean, I just told this joke about my friend. I mean, I feel so bad talking about my friend, a dear friend of mine, a best friend of mine. You know, her husband and her, a Buddhist, they got divorced. This is years ago. And then he was told he was like 40. He had this virulent cancer. He's going to be dead in 2 months. So she went back to live with him to help him die. Did the practices every day, supporting him. 2 months. 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, he didn't die. He became a living person again. He was called a dying person, with certainty. So they had to separate again. Do you understand? We are very foolish. So one, you're a living person, you believe it's true forever, and now you're a dying person. And the shock of your life, they come back. That's why in the West, there's this lovely book I read called The Undead. It's not about zombies. It's an amazing book. I mentioned it by this medical journalist, American medical journalist called Nick Teresi. The Undead. It's a very wonderful book. It's very funny. Very amazing book. And it's all the kind of the problems and the contradictions that are coming up these days in America in particular as a result of the farming organs business, you know, and it is a business, whatever it is. They're the top dogs the top dogs among all the doctors and get the highest prices, you know. So anyway, it's really interesting, all the different chapters. What was I saying? Some point I was going to make, I'm sorry. I lost the plot. Oh, dear. Anyway, this is my wonderful book, and all the contradictions that are coming up. Yeah, exactly, about what is a dead person, what is a living person. There used to be real comfort in the medical world, scientific world, about when a dead person is when they stop breathing, brain dead, that's it. But they all the time they're reporting people coming back to life. And there's always stories about this, people knocking on the coffin, you know. But we're so scared of it, we don't like to report it as a proper thing. We think, oh, that's just too weird. People who aren't dead on the operating table, but people whose liver they got ready to go, and then mummy says, no, put the liver right back. All these changes. And so even as a result, another thing too interesting, very interesting chapter, he reported a whole bunch of out-of-body experiences of people on the operating table. He says he's an atheist, but he reported all these things. It's very fascinating. So many of the people, of course, when the doctors hear that they heard what was being said, they were cynical. No, they would have heard this, blah, blah, blah. Not possible. That'd be ridiculous, you know. But there was one case he reports that was such, the woman needed such a radical procedure that they practically had to make her dead before they did the procedure, which meant from their perspective, from the medical perspective, there was no way in the world she could possibly have any consciousness whatsoever. But she reported the most vivid out-of-body experience, describing exactly what all the jokes they cracked, the music they played, the things they did, the instruments they used, and they couldn't possibly argue with her. So, it's just, and I think it's great this is coming up now, because they're not so sure after all when death is, you know, which has a really important role in the Buddhist understanding, which we'll talk about during the weekend, especially the one about giving your organs. Very, very important. So one doctor was reported as saying in the book, he quoted him, "I can say now with certainty that consciousness is not a function of the brain. I haven't got a clue what it is, but I can say that much." So that's great. Really helpful, you know, it's great, really questioning these things. And it's particularly important when you have to, you know, only have a half an hour in hospital, they've got to take the body away, or especially important when you're going to give your organs, and we'll discuss this in the weekend. It's very interesting, very, very interesting, you know. It's a very fascinating book, The Undead. So, okay, the time of death is uncertain. This should be enough to really cause us to be incredible practitioners. Because why? This is the third point. This is the conclusion. This is the action point. This is the point now. So, given a series of givens, given the Buddha's view, of course, that we know, that your consciousness is beginningless and endless, as mad as it sounds, given that every millisecond of what we think and do and say programs our consciousness, leaving seeds in our consciousness that, unless you pull them out, good or bad, will ripen in the future in that consciousness as our happiness or suffering. This is like the creation principle in Buddhism. As His Holiness says, it's like self-creation. This is the Buddha's explanation of the universe, that every sentient being is the product of their own handiwork, not a creator and not mummy and daddy. So it's kind of intense. Given that every millisecond of what's labelled a negative action will leave it a seed in the mind that will necessarily ripen as my suffering in the future, and given that every microsecond of a virtuous action will leave a seed in my consciousness that will necessarily ripen in the future as my happiness, and finally, obviously, no-brainer, given, guess what, I do not want suffering, and yes, please, I do want happiness, then it follows logically. The only thing that is of any use to me at the time of death is my virtuous seeds in my mind. That's it. It's a logical deduction based upon this view. This is the point. It all comes to this. It all comes to this. Which means, of course, everything that we, even as nice, good Buddhists, nice people, we are nice people, doing a good job being kind and loving and not killing and not lying, definitely nice people. But everything that we think about most in our daily life, everything that is of utmost importance to us, like our body, like our health, like our mummy, our daddy, our house, our pension plan, our money, our salary, our sisters, our brothers, our babies, our grandchildren, all of the components of this life that we have created, given that they are what we consider most important, given that they are the basis of most of our decisions, or they're the result of our they are the recipient of all our decisions in life, because we consider them most important. They're the reason we create negativity. They're the reason we get attached, fearful, jealous, neurotic, paranoid, depressed, hurt, etc. Given that that's normal, that's called samsara, join the club. Given that this prevails in our mind most of the time, until we're really advanced. That's okay, we're all like it. And we consider these the most important, and therefore we are utterly attached to them. And attachment, don't think of some cute word, it's got primordial depth attachment, you know. It's got multifacets, and it's a huge, profound state of mind. We can only understand it the deeper we go ourselves. You can learn the books until the cows come home. As Lama Yeshe says, I can tell you about attachment one whole year. We will only ever begin to taste it, know it, feel it, experience it when we go deep inside. There's no shortcut, you know. But this is the source of our pain in daily life, and therefore the source of the nightmare of death for most sentient beings. Which is why, at the time of death, dying like that is the cause for a negative karmic seed to be triggered, which then programs us, even before we stop breathing, to go to the lower realms. This is too shocking for our ears, you know. I've heard the teachings, and the more we understand these teachings, the more we understand Buddha's view of samsara, what it is, what causes it, what is attachment, what is delusion, the more we really study the stuff in depth, the more evident it becomes that the vast majority of all humans on this earth at this moment, when they die, they will be reborn in the lower realms. So given this, is Rinpoche's point, that the most important time in your loved one's life for you to help them is when they're dying. This is a literal point. We're going to spell it out during the weekend. A literal point. And to know exactly how to help them. Because he says, I cannot stress enough the role of you and other helpers in determining whether your loved one goes to the lower realms or the upper realms when they die. This is just, so it's very powerful, that concept, you know. Which is why we have to be clear about when the karmic seed that does determine our next life is triggered. And that for me, even though I've studied all this stuff, you kind of think you know. And I remember asking a few of my friends, when do you think the karmic seed is triggered? Everybody, all my Buddhist friends, everybody had a different opinion. I was shocked. Because when you look at the teachings and hear them, it's not that evident, you know. So one has to really look at it carefully. I asked many of the Geshe, including Geshe La here. He was so kind in many answers he gave me. I spoke to different ones, so many answers. I spoke to one Geshe. I said, well, that Geshe says this. He says, well, he's wrong. There are so many interpretations. So, you know, Rinpoche gives all his teachings and I can't make up what he's saying. So many of them just took months of questioning and asking to get super clear so you can confidently say, based on the Lama's teachings, that it would seem pretty certain that it's before we stop breathing, before, as Pabongka Rinpoche says, before the gross consciousness ceases, which is before you stop breathing, that is when the karmic seed that is triggered, that is the one that has already put you on autopilot, before you even stop breathing in the past life. Because so that period is when that person needs you most. It's really precise, you know. So there's, oh yeah, help my mummy die, I'll be there and hold her hand. No, much more precise than that. There are so many amazing things we can do to help our pussy, our cat, our dog, you know, not just go send them to the vet and kill them, you know, not like that. To help them die peacefully and virtuously. This is the point. And that's our job. That's the education we need. Not just hospice people. We all are going to have someone who's going to die. It's no question. Because at that time is when the karmic seed is triggered. And that is when you need to be happy, peaceful and virtuous. And we're going to discuss all this, you know. And at that time, all that you can rely on, the only thing that you can take with you, we know this, it's such a cliche, but so profound, is your virtuous karmic imprints. And how do they get there? From your virtuous actions throughout your life. That's it. Attachment, your loved ones, your body, your health, your food, your house, your pension plan, all the things that we assume we just naturally, you know, see every day and maintain, they are utterly essenceless at the time of death. And your negative states of mind, they're the worst possible. You don't want to have anything to do with them. So, no brainer, when do you start preparing for death? Now. Very clear, very clear. So there are two things from that. When you start practicing and know how to live your life so you do have bucket loads of virtuous seeds, so you will die peacefully and virtuously because you've let go of attachment, let go of fears, let go of the dramas, then you'll not only be ready to die yourself, but you're able to help others, which is the miracle. Because most people do not know how to die. Most people have primordial fear. My friend of mine, Lenny, I always quote this. She worked in the hospice movement in California years ago, 30 years ago, you know. She said it was just a given among hospice nurses, workers, that most people die with fear. And that fear is what triggers a negative karmic seed that throws them into the lower realms. This is like technical stuff, you know. It's not emotional. It's not blame. It's not speculation. It's on the basis of all these teachings coming from the greatest yogis who direct experience this stuff is, you know. So the more we can learn it, the more we can have confidence ourselves, the less fear we will have, and the more we'll know how to help. We'll have this education, as Rinpoche puts it, you know. And there's marvelous teachings out there. So many excellent teachings by His Holiness. Such amazing stuff in all the literature to really help us understand the process of death. And how to and be ready to understand, to recognize when your loved one starts to die. These things, you know. Be in charge, be controlled, be unemotional, be loving, be helpful. And there's so many ways to help your loved ones. And we're going to go to all of this, you know. I remember when Steve Jobs died. I remember reading Steve Jobs' biography. People will say he was a bit of a Hindu, a bit of a Buddhist. I'm not sure. I read his biography and there was hardly a mention of anything like that. And it was a very frank biography. But he was I liked Steve Jobs. He's an amazing human being, you know. People said he was aggressive and all that. I'm sure he was, but he had wonderful qualities, in my opinion. Not to mention, I admire his products anyway. So anyway, the thing is, I remember he was told he was going to die, you know. And he knew for many months and years, and you could see by the way he spoke, he was really in touch with impermanence and not wasting your life, blah, 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 right? So his sister, they'd been adopted, I think, and they met again, and then when they got older, and then she was there on the day he died. And it was very moving the way she told it, you know? She said, something like this, she said, but this blows my mind. She said he was packed, ready to go. That's great, that's delicious, you know? We need to be packed, ready to go. And what do we want to pack? Our virtuous imprints. That's it. Not another thing is necessary. This is the pain for most people. Attachment to things and family and beloveds. But two, as Rinpoche says, the deepest attachment is to this one, this body. The one that we identify with most of all, you know. So it really is a full-on job to start using the idea that we're going to die, which is a fact, to energize us to want to give up attachment. You know, it's very powerful. Because as long as we believe we're permanent, why would you want to give up attachment? No reason whatsoever. So it's such a profound one, and that's why it's in junior school, grade one, right at the first stages. It's, you know, as I said, a teacher's got this agenda to give us a wake-up call. So marvelous, you know. Then it sets the tone for all the rest of the path, you know. Getting everything into perspective, because it's a fact. Death's a fact. So fearful. It's not in its nature fearful. As Rinpoche says, we make it fearful because we can't stand the thought of it. We can't bear the thought of not being me. It is beyond terrifying to us because we cling most to this self, you know, this body, this I, you know. Any questions? Just about this first point, about preparing ourselves, living life well. Yes. Joan, what's your question, darling?
Hello, Venerable Rabina.
Yes.
I'm so happy to be in your presence every night, and I really
good,
appreciate
Rita.
Your teachings.
Bit closer to the mic. I'm treated like an ice cream. You've got to lick it, you know. Get close.
You know, when you mentioned that fear triggers negative karmic seeds.
At the time of death, yes.
At the time of death.
Yes.
And when, these days with medications.
Yes.
We give people medications.
That's right.
And they look to us like
that's right. Peaceful. That's right.
Do you think there's a way of knowing?
There is a way of knowing, of course. From the Buddhist perspective, it's very clear, yeah.
Can
of
you
course
see it? Do you feel it? What do you
think? No. It's more practical than that. Okay. This means we have to understand the death process, which of course we're going to go into in great detail in the weekend, all right? Can't do it all tonight. But I'll just talk briefly now that you've asked it. So, okay, of course, in our materialist culture, scientifically, as far as we're concerned, the person is dead when the breath stops, isn't it? Which means the Buddhist... So if we take the Vajrayana model, which is really important in this process, we're going to discuss it, and this is the same model of the actual way we are constructed that the Tibetan medical system uses. And it's very fascinating. And of course, it's absolutely not how we think in the materialist view. But according to that model, we've got what they call gross consciousness, which is inextricably linked to gross physicality. So for us, that's this body, and then our consciousness, which is linked to this body. And they're inextricably linked. So the process, the death process in this Vajrayana model is described in terms of eight stages. The first four is the complete deconstruction and ceasing of what's called gross consciousness. That means your eyes, your ears, your tactile, the five senses, and the certain capacity, they call it these wisdoms, it's a certain the capacity for our mind to hold information, to remember things, to distinguish between pleasure, pain, enemies and friends. All this is deconstructing. By the time you stop breathing, you've completely lost the plot, okay? You don't remember anything, your gross consciousness has ceased, which means you're mainly a sensory, and you stop breathing. Now that for the West is the end, because that's all we posit, is it not? We posit the brain. So that's, you're not dead yet, that's really super clear for this model. So now the point that's fascinating is that the death process is identical in this model. In terms of psychologically and physiologically, the process is identical to the sleep process, but it's a more radical one. So when we get to the point where when we become asleep and your senses have ceased, you know, you touch a person, they can't feel. You open their eyelid, the eye consciousness is gone. Okay, there's a very particular way of describing what's happened to the consciousness, and we'll do that tomorrow in this model, very different. But we can see that they're not conscious. The senses have ceased. But they're clearly still there because the breath is happening, isn't it? So the death is just more radical, but it's the same process. So then we all know when you go to sleep, then you wake up into dreams, don't you? And they're weird and wacko and strange things. They're not necessarily friendly. They can be real. So therefore, this is the point I'm getting to. At the time you stop breathing, now the subtle consciousness, which is the same level of consciousness that we dream with, exactly the same. And so you know very well you could be fast asleep, looking really peaceful, and you could be having the worst nightmare in the universe, couldn't you? But you're not moving an inch. Oh, she looks so peaceful. She had such a deep sleep, Rabina, and there I am having nightmares. We know that's possible, right? Well, that's the same here. Subtle consciousness. And you see, I mean, my friend Lenny, she said, you know, having this Buddhist view, people on all their drugs or out of their brains, unconscious, but so stressed, clinging at the sheets, tossing, turning, you know. Absolutely, clearly not peaceful. At their subtle consciousness level. People you hear about who've been in comas for months. I remember one fellow reporting. They were like, he lived like in these nightmares, for just endless nightmares. That's his subtle consciousness. And all of this is all our stuff in, that we store in our mind, popping up in these weird, weird shapes and sizes, which is our own mental projections. All our own stuff. So then there you are dying. And there's a deep instinct about dying. Animals have it. Humans have it. Even though we aren't able to say the word, you know. So there's enormous fear. And I mean just naturally. And this is where another model kicks in. Okay. It's from Sutra teachings. And it's called the 12 links of dependent arising. I mentioned this during the week. So, and this is Rinpoche. There's a small chapter of Rinpoche's book. This is so helpful. And this one took me, I told you, months to learn this one. I'd never studied the 12 links. And to put this piece in, I had to study it. But it's very, very helpful. So at the time, at every second, we're creating these 12 links, which is like new sets of rebirths. Every day, we're creating thousands of these whole sets of 12 links that perpetuate rebirth after rebirth after rebirth. So the process of gradually working on our mind is like a reversal of those 12 links, you know? There are different things that happen. First consciousness, then karma, then impermanence, then this, then that. Then. So at the eighth and the ninth are called craving and grasping. And they turn often, they're translated differently. But basically they're referring to two levels of attachment. So normally in daily life, the mind's ticking over all the time, attachment. Thinking about things, wanting things, aspiring for things, getting things, craving things. Then the feeling of emptiness, what do I feel? Oh, I feel like cake. That's craving. And then grasping makes you stand up and go get the cake. Grasping is sort of puts into practice the craving's needs, right? But at death, Rinpoche says, taking these 12 links, this craving and grasping play a really powerful role, okay? So there you are dying, and this craving is so intense, and what the craving is for, of course, is for this, for the status quo. And you think about attachment. You think about attachment. One of its main jobs is always perky and thinking about what, and looking forward to something. Look at our minds, berserk, uncontrolled. Always, now I'm going to do this, now I'm going to do that. When I go to here, now I'm going to go there. I'll have lunch, and I'll go there. I'll go wash the dishes, and I'll go to this, and I'll have dinner, prepare the dinner, go to shopping, get this, do that. This is attachment energy. So when it's all buoyant and sort of perky, that's attachment. But when something bad goes and your hubby leaves you, what do? You go crashing down to despair, and you have nothing to look forward to. So one of the jobs of attachment is always looking forward to something. But if you are heading to death and you've never thought about God or heaven or reincarnation because you're a materialist, you have nothing to look forward to. So it is beyond terror. Except the only thing you look forward to is a black hole. And who wants to fall into a black hole? Thank you very much. So no wonder. And my friend Lenny said, and I'm getting to your point now. My friend Lenny said, it's just a given that most people die with fretting and fear, even when they're in comas. There's so much fear and stress. And she said the only people she noticed who didn't have fear were those who had a spiritual path. And the simple point there is obvious. They were looking forward to going to God. That's attachment. But they were perky. Do you understand? I haven't finished yet. Sorry. So I'm getting to this point. So there you are. You're on drugs because you're in pain. You're already freaking out. But in our culture, I think we can't distinguish between the mental anguish and the physical pain. We think it's all to do with the physical. So we give masses of drugs. I'm not being rude now. Morphine, whatever, to make the person be peaceful, as we put it. And because they're quiet looking, we assume that because their gross consciousness is not that they're peaceful. No, their minds are out of their brains with fears and nightmares and panics because their mind at the gross level was panic stricken. You know, if you have an anguished day because your husband just left you, you're not going to have blissful dreams, believe me. You're going to have nightmare dreams. Because it's an extension. The subtle is an extension of the gross, you know. So the point about drugs. The crucial thing is to be conscious as possible. To be as aware as possible. I remember even Precious Lama Yeshe, who was the greatest yogi. He never slept. He would have sleep every afternoon because of his bad heart. But he was a great yogi. He didn't go to sleep. He went to his subtle consciousness and he meditated. And even he said in one letter to one of his yogi brothers, you know, one of his dear friends, that these drugs they gave him really made his mind so demented. And he was a great yogi. Who had powerful mind. So it's the worst thing to make a person drugged out of their brain. The worst. Because they're going to have much more fear. I know myself when I was really sick one time and they gave me morphine. And my mind was in such a mess, such a distress. I couldn't put two and two together. You can't possibly keep, even as you're dying, you're distressed. You can't put two and two together because your mind's getting weaker. So to all then be zonked out on drugs, the worst possible. So, and the thing is, you can really see that when people are peaceful, somehow the pain never gets that. It's not the worst thing. Their mind being peaceful is what's most important, you know? So therefore, that's the worst way to die. The worst.
And to, as part of that, to for me to I want to try to help others die well.
That's right.
And so how do I? Because everyone isn't a Buddhist.
We're going to do all that tomorrow, darling.
I'm sorry, I won't be here.
Well, so I'm sorry, John. I can't
that's
help.
That's all right.
You.
Okay. Well,
you're gonna have to listen to the recording or read the book or something. But just briefly here, you know, there's so many things, and the essence of it is this, Joan. And you, if you want to help people, you're going to have to read this book, because it's just a great manual, and you can't just get it in 1 second, you know? I know you know that. So the key point, when you understand the essential point, is in up to where they stop breathing. In that period, the days before, even the week before, there is your job, your main job, is to make this person feel to trust you, to hold on, to rely on you, not all clingy and attached, to rely on you and for you to give them courage and to help their mind be virtuous and peaceful. That means you have to know their mind. So let's say your mummy, she's a Christian, you know? So maybe she hasn't talked much about God, but there she is with this massive fear, not knowing what to hold on to. She's got nothing to hold on to. She's kind of got no anchor and she's got complete panic. Nothing to look forward to. You finally know you're going to die and you have no clue what's going to happen. It is beyond terror for most people. So let's say she didn't have a God. Now she might remember to think about God, but you can talk to her about God. Be brave. And then she might be so excited to hold on to something. And then you tell her God loves her. Remember, she says, it's one of the practices. Talk about God. Talk about how God loves her. God is wisdom. God is compassion. God is thinking of you. God is embracing you. Anything you want to say, that could be, oh, the relief for her mind, because that can make her peaceful and hold on to something and look forward to something. You tell her how beautiful heaven is. Maybe, you know, most times when we're helping people who die, we're scared to open up a topic. So you've got to know where the person's at and therefore know. But the key thing is, if you don't talk about heaven or anything, you know, or whatever, this is the way I put it, you know. You know when you're really freaked out, something terrible happens, the first thing we do is think of somebody we can turn to. Do we not do that? Do we not do that? And that's where, if we don't have someone to turn to, we're so despairing. But we are frantic to find one human being who can we cry to cling to, whom we know will understand us. It's like heaven on earth. We are desperate for that. Would you agree, people? I always think, this for me is our most outrageous example. You know when you're a kid, and the smallest thing happens, but it's like the end of the universe, isn't it? You're screaming hysterically, you're kind of tears, you nearly want to kill yourself, and where you make a, if you're lucky to have a mother, if a nice mummy, you make a beeline for mummy. And you're wide-eyed and panic-stricken, and she sees you, and you're screaming, and Johnny did this, and this is what blows my mind. What does mummy do? Oh, darling, it's all right, and gives you a big hug, and guess what? You believe her. You calm down, because she made you feel peaceful. Because when you're freaking out, you can't hold anything inside yourself. You've got to have and that's how most people, these poor old people in these vegetable homes, they're treated like animals. I mean, it makes me just cry when I see it. With televisions blaring and drugged out of their brains, you know? I mean, it's beyond bearing. One old lady I went to, the mother of somebody, paranoid, deluded, angry, neurotic old thing. Demented, you know. We just sang a mantra. All it was for her ears was a sweet sound. Instantaneously, she calmed down. So what Rosé says, make the room beautiful. That should be the best scenario. Have an ideal best room. Everything in it, this is what I'm saying, everything in it should only be for the benefit of that person. And the next thing is this. When we remember, due to karma, this is a karmic view, whatever any sentient being sees and hears, most of all, these senses are so powerful, will have a powerful, leave an powerful impression on their mind. Like putting, one Lama said, it's like, all day we're taking photos of everything our senses experience, and we store them all in our mind. So your pussy, your dog, the poor mouse, the ant, you let it hear mantra. Let it hear the teachings of the Buddha. It'll put incredible imprints in its little mind. Not to mention, if it's a very sweet sound, your poor demented grandma will calm down. It will soothe her. And the added bonus is its mantras. She doesn't know. She doesn't have to know. So you help them be peaceful and therefore and connect. And when the mind is peaceful, this is logical, the mind is virtuous. Virtue and peace come utterly together. Check the last time you were loving, you're peaceful. Check the last time you were angry, you're demented and distressed. So negativity and unpeaceful come together. So when the mind is peaceful, the space where that grasping comes, with the craving, then the grasping, that grasping is what triggers the karmic seed. But if your mind's peaceful and then you're hearing virtue and hearing your practice, then that triggers a virtuous seed. And that's when the karma is already determined for your next life, before you even stop breathing. That's when they need you most. Precisely then. With me. So make the room beautiful, make it peaceful. Everything they see, everything they hear is conducive for them to be peaceful and virtuous. And you have to know the person's mind. You know? I mean, if they're Christian, you don't play them, you don't show them Tara. They get a shock seeing a naked green lady. Show them Jesus, you know? Whatever, you understand. You've got to know their mind and know what you can say and can do. Do you understand? And quiet is the most precious thing. Even if they're in a coma, treat it like a holy place with sounds of prayers and mantras day and night, peacefully and quietly. And for your mouse, the cat, exactly the same. Because the only thing that can help your animal is this. Nothing else. Do you understand? This is the point. And especially that period. After as well, but that's when the karma's triggered. That's when they need you more than anything. Of course, you don't know when they're going to die. But you've got to get a sense. And often doctors and nurses can tell you. It'll be a few hours yet. So even if they're unconscious, that's when they need you. Hearing the prayers. And there's certain things to do physically as well. Things to put in here. Mantras to put in a whole bunch of things. In this little kit bag, you know. She has all these things. We'll talk about in the weekend. Do you understand? Okay. What else? Questions? Yes.
So, I've seen a lot of dying, and
yes,
dying can be a torture rack. The physical body, it's hard to be peaceful when the torture rack is.
You mean that's the physical pain? It's so true, isn't it? So true, isn't it? Yes, it's
and
terrible.
So. We're to be guided by compassion.
Sorry?
So we're to be guided by compassion. So
yes.
I'd like to know what has His Holiness said about dying with dignity and aiding the person who's dying?
These teachings would be the same as His Holiness would give, and they are given. There's a beautiful book, many beautiful books by His Holiness, but there's one in particular that I think it was published under one name, but now it's called The Mind of Clear Light, and it's edited by Professor Jeffrey Hopkins, and it's a commentary on a text by Panchen Turki Gyaltsen, I think, one older Tibetan master from a couple hundred years ago. And it's very wonderful advice. It's the same advice that all the lamas, because they've all come from the same place. So the advice that Rinpoche gives, this book we're discussing here, will be exactly the same advice that Rinpoche gives, His Holiness gives. Maybe different variations, but the same thing, because they're both coming from the same system.
And what about organ donation?
Yeah. Would you plan to come in the weekend as well or not? Just tonight? It's okay, I don't mind.
Just tonight.
No, fine, okay. I'll talk about it now then. Well, this is one of the sections, what to do if your loved one wants to give their organs. Now, this is a really fascinating thing, actually. Okay. Years and years ago, 25 years ago, when Karuna Hospice in Queensland started, the monk that started it, he interviewed many lamas from different traditions about, asked many questions all about death and dying. It's very fascinating. We published it in Mandala, I think in 95, 20 years ago. It's available. If anybody wants it, I'm very happy to send you the PDF. You just have to ask me, okay? So, one of the topics, of course, what about the karma for a person who wants to give their organs? Does that disturb their peace? You know, because the ideal scenario for the Buddhists, as I mentioned, is once they stop breathing, you don't touch them for 3 days. That's completely contradicted by giving organs, you know? So, I always understood myself, and I know Lama Zopa Rinpoche did, and all these lamas who asked the question, in giving their answer, it's a marvelous thing to do, such compassion, so special, and the karma for that person would be perfect, you know. But every one of them assumed, which is what I assumed, that when you stop breathing, you know, you close the hospital door, leave me alone, please. You're allowed to keep the body for a couple of hours once they've stopped breathing. You do all the practices, which is what's recommended, which is in this book, which we're going to talk about the weekend. And then you give them the body, once you are sure that the mind has left the body. But that's not how it is. And this is what's so fascinating about this book, this undead guy, the undead book. He was quite cynical, in fact, about the whole industry. I'm just telling you what he said. I'm just reporting. And he even at some point said, I really wish they would spend as much money and care on me when I'm old and dying and don't want my organs as they do on the people whose organs they want, who keep them all healthy and, you know, warm and toasty. You understand? To spend masses of money and time on keeping the person fresh because they want their organs. And he was being cynical. He was just giving his very interesting report and all the problems from this. And even the point is this too. So when I heard this, and then I happened to have a meeting with Rinpoche about, and for this particular section, what if your loved one gives their organs, then let me read you what Rinpoche said, okay? And this is the answer to your question. And this is just before the book got done, so I was very relieved that I heard this, because I didn't just assumed that this is how it would be, you know, that you'd be able to have the body. And the Buddhist view is once they stop breathing, there's certain things you can do to help the consciousness, because the subtle consciousness is still there, they say. And there's certain things you can do to make sure the consciousness leaves, and that would be then fine. Whatever you do, you can do it, you know, but that wouldn't be good for the West, because they want a nice, toasty, warm body, don't they, for organs. So, okay, remember she said... Some people decide to offer their organs to others after they've died. Does this disturb the mind? Well, it seems that the person is considered when the person is considered brain dead, the doctors keep the body breathing artificially, and they continue to keep the body breathing when they actually cut out the organs. Now, the point is for the Buddhist view, it's this: once you stop breathing, it still could be 3 days before you get through the continuing of the process to subtle consciousness and what they even call then very subtle consciousness. But from the materialist point of view, there's no evidence of this. You can't see that the consciousness is still there, which is why they all call you brain dead. But the Buddhist view is, and you're not going to be there for it, but we can describe it in the weekend, the whole process of death is this gradual deconstruction of all the components of the body, and that includes the elements, and this is similar to the Hindu view, the wind energies, the subtle air energy in the body, and the way we die, this process, all the energy, and including the warmth, everything gathers here at what they call the heart chakra. And it's very detailed the way they describe this process. So it's easy to prove from this perspective that the mind is still there. All you've got to do is put your hand over here and you'll feel it's vividly warm. And that means the mind is still there. Do you understand? Even if they stop breathing for 2 days, if you put your hand above the heart chakra, because if the very subtle consciousness is still in the body, then you'll feel warmth right here, and it'll be vividly warm. It'll be distinct from the rest of the cold body. It'll be frozen, but here could be distinctly warm. For the Buddhist, that's clear that the consciousness is still in the body. So if the consciousness hasn't even gone through the subtle process yet, not all the way to the very subtle, then people have not, they're not died yet. They haven't got the karma to die yet. That's why many people come back to life. So they stop breathing, which the West calls dead, but the subtle mind is there. And that's why the people, it's shocking to us in the West, but they can come back to life because they haven't finished. And this happens very common, apparently. Are we communicating so far?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting to the point. Okay. This is the background. So this is very interesting. In this book, this fellow, this Mr., you know, Dick Tracy, he reporting all the different experiences of nurses and all the contradictions that are coming up. When is death? When is not death? Blah, blah. It's an amazing book, actually. I recommend it. The Undead. So he said there was a report from one nurse, because what happens, they keep you breathing, all toasty and warm, right? Which means, as far as Rinpoche is concerned, okay, I'll read what he says and I'll explain what this book said. Okay, sorry. I can't find it now. Okay. It seems that when the person is considered brain dead, the doctors keep the body breathing artificially, and they continue to keep the body breathing when they actually cut out the organs. Well, I question this. Even if the brain is no longer functioning, if the person has the karma to breathe, meaning if you're capable of breathing even artificially, this means that they're still alive, which means that the mind is still in the body. And of course, this view of the mind is not the Western view. Do you understand? It's consciousness, subtler. And there's no obvious evidence except for that warmth. And that's a very clear way to see it. It's very easy, even on your dog and your cat as well. So the point is this, that one nurse reported that because the person is brain dead, they've been keeping her breathing, they take the body to the operating theatre, because they consider the body dead, they don't give us an anaesthetic, they get this big circular saw and start to carve her from here to here. And the heart started beating, went from 100 beats to 200 beats a minute. And he wondered what, the nurse wondered what a dead body's heart is doing going up to 200 beats a minute. I mean, that, it seems to me there's something there, you know. Do you see my point? Are you seeing my point? I'm asking you to believe this view, but are you seeing the point? So therefore, the Buddha's view is, if the mind is still there, you're not sure until you know the mind has left, which is, and this is the way to prove it, that they're not going to come back to life. It's not uncommon for people who've stopped breathing. People even, there's so many stories, but people don't like to hear about these things, of people in coffins who look like they're brain dead, but they're not dead yet. So then that easily could be that person could come back to life. And that means, even though Rinpoche says, if the person's brain dead, they might not feel anything. But, you know, it's like people have out-of-body experiences. When you're dreaming, this is so common report, that you can be easily having this vision of you, your body being sawed. No wonder the heartbeat double, you know? So it's just dangerous because the person might be dead yet, and it could be quite difficult for their consciousness. Could leave the wrong way, and the Buddhist view, of course, because of reincarnation, if the mind freaks out, then it will, you know, it can change everything and could leave in the wrong way and could take a very suffering rebirth. I don't know if that answers your question. This is the Buddhist view, you know. So until you really, you know, and because of course they want the body to be all warm and toasty. They don't want a cold body. So it's really a complicated thing. I mean, all I know is I've got second thoughts. I'd rather give my smelly old body to one of those doctors and they can cut all of me up and use me to help to become better doctors. They can have my heart and things. It's very nice. It sounds very noble. And it is noble. It's amazing. But it's not the only way to help others, you know. In my opinion, my personal opinion. Okay, does that answer people's question about the organ business? So it's a tricky one. And it's a tricky one. So I remember when Tim died here, you know, Tim Powell. Who was with him at the time of death? But you guys were doing it, and then you had to be thrown out of the room all the time, weren't you? Because they had to do different things on him, right? But you did prayers and stuff for him, didn't you? And then finally they took him at midnight. All his organs were gone by midnight, weren't they?
They took him at midnight.
So he was considered brain dead by noon?
Noon,
and then all his organs gone by. See, I remember Lama Zopa saying, couldn't they leave it longer? You know, of course not, they're all dying to get the... I'm not being rude, it's nice to give organs. But you know, you can't say that Tim's mind... Did you check to see if his mind left the body? But if he's breathing, it couldn't have left the body. That's the whole point. That means if he's breathing... You see, in other words, if the subtle consciousness had actually left the body, it would be impossible for him to be breathing. You can't make a dead body breathe. Do you understand? And you couldn't have a dead body be warm. It's literally impossible. Whereas that's what they think in the West. It's warm and breathing, and they think it's dead still. So it's so peculiar. I mean, what do they think that's keeping it warm, you know? If it's not consciousness. Sort of interesting, isn't it? So you did prayers, and Geshe-la did all that stuff afterwards as well?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Interesting topic. All people as well. Fantastic. Let's hope, you know. Any more questions? Because we're going to go into detail on the weekend. We can't do follow too much here, but for anybody who might be here tomorrow, do you have any more particular questions who won't be here for the weekend? Yes, darling.
My father passed away, and he passed away very peacefully. And the one thing I was going to comment on was that we kept telling him that I told him I would be there. He was there for me when I was born, I will be there for him when he dies, and that seemed to make things very peaceful, and
wonderful.
He was able to attach.
You gave him courage, you know, you kind of gave him, you made him feel secure.
A lot of my family, after about 5 days, I don't know what the Buddhist teaching is of the consciousness after it leaves the body. You said yesterday that everyone around us is there for a purpose and a reason that we may have in this life. That people that come into our life have been another...
Oh, not a purpose so much as we've got a karmic connection. We've done
that before.
That's right.
So that consciousness, does it have a karma connection also?
What do you mean?
To us that are still alive.
No, not necessarily. Once, okay. 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 Once the consciousness has stopped breathing, and then eventually after a day or three the consciousness has actually left the body, and there are very clear ways of this happening and knowing, and to, you know, and knowing at whether it's happened, there's no longer any, it's finished in that particular form. This particular group of people you've got in your family now, and who are connected to that person as your father or something, let's say, once he's dead and the karma is created now for him to be born as an Australian girl to a Chinese mother in Melbourne, you know, that's another whole group he's got karma with now. You've still got karma connection with him, and maybe in other lives you'll meet him, but at that time, that's finished. And they even, as Lama Zopa says, when the mind has left the body, when it leaves the body, and straight away it wakes up into this kind of another state, like a dream state, which is called the intermediate state. He said, even from there, you can even see your body of the past life, but you're not. The karma's completely finished. You will recognize none of it. You'll have no wish to go back because it's finished. So, you know, the mind of your father might have left, and before it went, as it's in the intermediate state, it's like an out-of-body state, but it's really definitely out-of-body state. He can even see you all and the body itself, but there's no recognition, no wish to go back. Finished. Karma finished.
Okay, because there was, you know, I've heard from several of my family members, you know, that we felt still a presence there.
I know many people say that, don't they? It's very interesting, isn't it?
And does the Buddhist have an explanation?
Yeah, that's the intermediate state being. But he won't recognize you. You can feel him around. I mean, that's a subtle consciousness.
Right.
That he can even still see that body that he came from. You can't pinpoint where it is, but it's existing, and it hasn't maybe got a new birth yet. Then
right.
It's very easy to feel.
I guess you feel like a heavy presence
It could be that. It's not impossible, yes.
Okay.
Not impossible,
okay.
I'd say. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
What else, people? Especially those who won't be here the weekend, if you have particular questions. Maybe I've driven you away. You won't come back if you're thinking of coming. Any questions?
Yeah.
Where are you? Yes, sweetheart.
So, and I asked you a few days ago about my parents.
Yes.
So I know my mom wants to leave her organs, right?
Yes.
But now, based on what you're saying, right? And I'm just thinking this out, so
I understand.
Got it clear.
Sure. Yeah.
If, and let's just say I'm the guy in the room who, you know, who's in charge. Let's just say I am.
That's
not
right.
Not my bro.
That's right.
And I have all this knowledge that you're giving
me.
Yes,
that's right.
And I check the heart chakra, right? And I'm involved.
Okay, just a sec though. The point is this.
Yeah.
That if she's going to give her organs and they want her organs, let's say they want her organs.
Yeah.
The moment she's brain dead, they will have the machine on keeping her breathing, which means her mind can't leave.
Right.
Mind can't leave while she's breathing.
So if
therefore
I,
her mind is there.
Right. I know that. So if I let that happen,
yeah.
Then that's like, you know, I just know what the book says about killing your mom.
Well, no, it might no.
And the,
okay.
And the bad karma that brings up.
See, that's the point. You don't. Okay.
I don't.
The only time it'll be killing your mother is if she doesn't have the karma to die yet, and then she stops breathing, and then like some people comes back to life again. That's when it would be technically killing your mother because her karma hasn't finished. She's still going to come back to breathe. And some people do. Not the majority probably don't.
Okay.
But that's even some of the experiences he's quoting. People coming back to life. So that means they're not dead yet. So in other words, you can't be certain the person is dead until the mind has left the body. And it can't leave the body as long as it's breathing. So it's a bit catch-22.
So it is. It's risky.
So you've got to decide.
It's risky business.
It is risky business. And that's the point. And that's why even he's a materialist. He's really cynical about a lot of the consequences of this and the difficulties of it. And even one woman in here whose baby's organs were given to many others, she was so moved by it, she started volunteering at a place. And she said she stopped volunteering. She got so freaked out when she saw so many things that just didn't make her happy, you know. And I can't quote everything. I'm not trying to be horrible about it. But it's a really interesting book to read. And it's a lot of research. But it's I think the good side of it is at least it's questioning now what is consciousness and when is life, when is death. So it's an interesting topic now. That's the point. And I was so happy to hear that because I didn't know this, and that's when I could tell Lama Zopa, and he could say that in the book because he just assumed like everybody that you know you die, you're peaceful, the consciousness goes, you make sure the consciousness goes, then they can have their body. But no, not like that. So you've got to think about it.
So it's like a grey area.
Huh?
It's like a grey area.
It's difficult. That's all. It's now with this
view,
this Buddha's view, and if this is one you're taking on board. Nevertheless, Rinpoche also says that even if it could be difficult and, you know, like that heart beating, that for me is mind-blowing, that heart beating from 100 to 200 when they start sawing the body. I mean, if they're really dead, how in the name of God could that possibly happen, you know? That indicates the presence of consciousness to my mind. And even he questioned that, you know. He said, yeah, what's a dead body doing going from 100 to 200 beats a minute? The heart of a dead body. I mean, it was so fascinating, you know. And so, but nevertheless, Rinpoche does say, because the motivation was so pure to want to give your organs, that is pretty good for the person who's dying. Whereas another lama, just telling you this, Rinpoche didn't say it, so I can't put this other lama's words because it's not his book, but this other lama, a wonderful yogi I know, in one of the lamas in France, he said, of course, your mum's, let's say your mum, well, no, to forget your mum, it's too personal. But let's say, you know, I decided 20 years ago to give my organs, but then I become an old drunk alcoholic and a mean, nasty person and have lots of anger and rage. Excuse me, I can't see that's going to be much benefit when I'm dying of a horrible death. You understand? Because your mind can change at the time of death, can't it? You understand? So it's a tricky one. And I just find all this stuff quite helpful to talk about. And stuff. And the fact that this is an atheist reporting. Not, he's jokes about being an atheist, you know. And what was very bit sad was he reported many religions' views about death, but he didn't ever obviously didn't talk to a Tibetan Buddhist. That would have been really interesting for him, but he never did. For some reason, he missed that out. But it's a very interesting book. I was fascinated by it.
The Undead.
Yeah. And he's very funny, cracks jokes and things. Anyway, what other questions? Yes.
Just thinking about it, so I mean, it sounds like there's an assumption that if the consciousness is still there, that taking organs out is the problem. But I mean, people but people, you know, can donate a kidney and still be alive, coming on the other side, and it's not really a bad thing. You know what I mean? Like,
say that pass again.
So people like you or I could donate a kidney.
But you have to be dead to do that, do you?
No, you can donate one kidney.
Oh, yeah, not two, okay.
Right, yeah, not both. Well, you wouldn't be dead, a bit bad idea.
I understand.
Have
both.
Yeah,
both.
Yeah. So you can donate, you know, one kidney, you can donate part of your liver,
and you come back
up, and that's, you know, you don't really remember it, and you're fine.
That's right.
But I mean, I guess is the concern or issue is that when they do these procedures, if they assume that there's no sensation, if they assume that there's
no
feeling...
Well, that's what they do. That's why they
don't
do this.
Right,
right. They only do it to... That's why they don't give anesthetic, because it's dead.
Right. So I don't know. I'm just sort of throwing this out there.
Yes, of course.
Nobody knows, but maybe that's the concern, is that, you know... So, for example, we had a...
Sorry, wait a minute. What's
the concern?
The concern
is that they're not...
You mean the Lama Zopa's concern?
So, yes, our concern from the Buddhist perspective... is that somebody undergoing organ removal, that's being done without anesthesia, that's being done without, you know, concern for their pain.
Okay, now wait. So this is, again, an interesting point. Sorry, say it again. If this, using this model, by the time the gross consciousness has ceased, and Rinpoche also says it, they won't feel anything. But their subtle consciousness, like a dream consciousness, or like the people who leave their body, can observe what's going on. So if the subtle consciousness would still be there, and that's capable of observing what's happening, even though they don't feel anything. So it's quite a bit of an interesting point that the heart doubles pace, the heart doubles...
Oh, she was just saying, so maybe it's the part about, like, the manner, like, if you're observing this and you're not being disturbed at the
It says, this is what I find interesting. I didn't tell Rinpoche that story about the heart beating double. I didn't tell him that. I saw it later. But all Rinpoche says is, if gross consciousness has ceased, you won't feel anything because the senses have ceased. But your subtle consciousness, this is me talking, your subtle consciousness can still be conscious of what's going on. You can be seeing your body, and there's still a connection with you and your body. You don't know you're dead, but your consciousness is still there, like in leaving. It's like the same experience as leaving. When the people have out-of-body experiences, that subtle consciousness, which is the same one that's still there now, and that's the one we dream with. And when there's people who left their body during their operation, who weren't dead people, who could vividly report what was going on, the subtle consciousness, this is me now extrapolating, could be observing this procedure. This body they know is theirs, being sawed down the middle. They won't feel it physically. But especially the point that Rinpoche is making is this, that if the person hasn't got the karma to die yet, and you don't know that until the mind has actually left the body, and the point is there because many people do come back to life. And that's what he reports in this book.
Sure.
This is why it's a contradiction, it's a problem. People come back to life.
Sure.
And that literally is murder. And that could freak the mind out. You understand? And you kill them, basically. Do you see my point? So it's because this is not what's been talked about in the West. That's why the Buddhist one, that's why you leave for 3 days to be really clear. You do lots of prayers and practices. And then there are vivid signs for when the mind has left. Now you can feed the thing to the dogs. No problem now. It's no longer a person. Yeah. Mind has gone.
I'll share just a very brief, and I think to this point, is that we had a family member who basically had a baby that was essentially stillborn. It had a, you know, abnormality, was not going to be viable. So there's just really, you know, we just passed it and died.
Yes.
So, you know, they said, okay, we're going to do a planned abortion for this.
Yes.
in which she didn't request it and wasn't standard practice.
Sorry, she didn't what?
What she did was went ahead and so, you know, had to have the abortion to kill the baby.
Yes. And sorry, what? I'm missing you.
So,
go on.
So is it clear that this baby was not viable?
Clear.
It was alive.
Okay. So there's a fetus in a womb,
yes.
And it was not going to survive.
Right.
But
correct.
It wasn't still alive already.
Yes. Heart still beating, still alive.
So what'd they do?
So basically the options were to let it be born and then immediately die.
So it would die naturally?
Die naturally.
Or,
and it might not even make it that far, or to actually go ahead and just abort it sooner rather than later to make
why
it...
Why wouldn't they allow the body to just to the person to take its own time and just be born when it's ready?
Then it was going to be, you know, as time went on, it was going to be more complicated, more risky medically.
For whom?
Well, the mother. I mean, the baby's, there's no risk there. Well, actually, the only risk there is that it would be getting older and more developed, and the thought was maybe it would be feeling more as it got more developed.
See, the Buddhist approach to this one is, you don't interfere. This is a sentient being, and it's karma that's got all this. So you take as much care of the mummy, you take as much care of the fetus, you know, each second that fetus is creating, is experiencing its own karma, it's finishing its karma, and let it run its own course. This is the Buddhist view. But we're such interveners in the West. We think we're God, you know, running around controlling life and death. Hang on a second, Michael. You understand? So what's your question, though?
Okay, well, I'll just throw this out there that one, you know, well, that's fine. I can just leave it at that. I guess one thing that's relevant to this conversation is that we insisted that they basically provide the baby, you know, anesthetics so it wouldn't feel any pain as part of it.
As being aborted.
Yeah, yes, correct.
So they aborted it.
Right, right.
So they did that. They gave it an anesthetic. Well, that's good.
Yes. Yeah, because they don't normally do that. So
and
again,
then it died.
Yes.
Anyway, immediately.
Yes.
Which it would have done anyway.
Yes.
So how kind. Yes, absolutely. So kind, giving anesthetic. That's extremely generous, extremely kind. And they wouldn't do it. Of course they wouldn't.
Right. So just a thought that maybe
that's
sometimes
extremely kind.
People don't think about anesthetic if, oh, they're dead, they can't feel. But
that's right,
you know,
but this is the point. I mean, this is the point. If they have, you know, but if they would at least give anesthetic, but then maybe still it wouldn't, because if they're not feeling anything, it's not going to help. It seems to me if they're hard, I mean, this is why I find it fascinating. If the subtle consciousness is still there, there's some awareness at some level. And even though sensorily they won't feel, but there's an awareness of it happening. Like if you, people who leave their bodies are observing. Like there's a friend of mine who got used to be raped all the time by her father and by something to be gross here, by dogs. You can't imagine. Hideous. I mean, she lost count. Every day, many people, she had to have sex with Alsatian dogs. I can't even describe. She left her body every time. And she had little fantasies in the sky, and she'd be watching this little agonized little girl dreading going back. But even though her consciousness is there, she's still breathing. So even though it feels like you're above your body, she's still there. It's her body. Therefore, the heart would beat fast, even though it's only the subtle consciousness, even though she wouldn't physically feel it. That's my way of putting it, you see.
That makes sense.
Because the connection is still with that mind.
Got
Once
it.
You're out of the body and you're in the intermediate state, the second you leave your body, you already become an intermediate state being. The karma is over and there's no connection any longer. So your daddy or your mummy, who you just said, the person behind you, they'd be seeing that body and you people, but they wouldn't recognize you. You might feel their presence, but they would not recognize you because the karma's over. Do you understand?
Yes.
So it's interesting. But that's interesting about the baby. That's, thank you very much. Back at there, somebody had a question. Yeah, go. Yeah. Yeah, you, sweetie.
Well, I'm thinking of throwing my organ donor card in the recycling, which means I won't be in the recycling act. But
there you go.
Mind that. The question isn't there any knowledge at this point about which organs are viable at the point that we're sure the consciousness leaves? Are they?
No, I think the only one is skin. Apparently, the only one they like of dead bodies is skin, I've heard.
So
I don't
once
know,
you're dead, the...
Okay. Any medical people here?
The eyes.
Okay, so maybe you just leave your eyes, and once you're dead... So I've got to be dead first and have my Buddhist person tell you I'm dead, then you can have my eyes. Okay, good idea. Give them your eyes, and that'll do. Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks, yes.
To finish his point for
yes,
me,
yes.
I think you said something about, well, if the mother is in danger from a child who is not going to be viable, is that a decision that doesn't really, well...
It's personal. I mean, some mothers will give their lives for their babies. You hear stories all the time. There's so much compassion. They will consciously decide to die so their baby can live. It all depends on the person. That's a personal choice, isn't it?
Okay.
That's a personal choice, you know.
I understand. Thank
you. Yeah, that's very much a personal choice, isn't it? And there was danger for your sister, was there? Was your sister, was it?
Yeah, and honestly...
Give it mine.
Yeah.
But
You know, to be honest, she was so, I mean, she wanted nothing more in the universe than the best for the baby. Anyone would think she's ridiculous. But she's an incredibly caring person.
Yes.
Her thing was that the baby was going to suffer for sure if it underwent a birth, and that was her biggest driver.
I understand. That's amazing. Yeah. Very wonderful. So. Very kind. Okay. Anybody else? Yes, sweetheart.
Thank you so much for being here.
The lady
here.
At the very back, the right at the back, with the mic at the very back, with the red scarf. Yes. Yes, go, sweetie. Yes.
Thank you for having this topic this weekend. It's very timely for
me. Good, fantastic. Why is that?
And
you're dying? You got cancer?
No.
You're dying? No. Okay.
I'm caring for a terminally
ill. Wonderful.
So, in terms of pain, and I hear you saying anesthetic, great, manage the pain.
Huh? I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. Sorry, my confusion.
That was anesthetic. If you're cutting the body open with a circular saw from head to foot.
I see.
Thank you. So kindly, please. At least, maybe.
I'm wondering. I'm getting the don't drug them out of their minds. Keep the fear, or try to create that peaceful environment.
Powerful, important point.
Yes.
Yes.
Is there any research or evidence that because death is generally perceived as painful, that there is any...
What do you mean it's perceived as painful? You mean scary. Sorry, not painful. It's not painful.
It's not painful
at all. Death, actually, the Buddha's view, as your mind gets more subtle, you literally become more blissful. Literally blissful. And that's why when you see some people who die with a virtuous state of mind, they're like, their eyes are shining, like they're seeing something radiant in front of them, because their mind's getting more peaceful, and they're seeing, like, it could be the Pure Lands, it could be the Buddha, because their mind's getting more subtle, therefore more powerful. But if a negative karma's ripened, their mind is like a complete panic nightmare, and it's the absolute opposite to blissful. So as your mind gets more subtle, it's getting more light, therefore more blissful, if virtue has been triggered. So death itself is not painful. Death is a blissful experience if you've got a virtuous karma ripening. Because the reason it's blissful, because the Buddha's view of reincarnation, you're seeing the new life coming. They say literally, the way that the yogis talk about it, it's like going towards the light. And they mean that literally. But a person whose negative karma has been triggered before they stop breathing, which is causing them to go to like an animal birth or even a worse type of rebirth, they have like visions of it coming, and it's like absolutely like a nightmare. So then for them it's like a nightmare. So it's due to the karma, whichever karma has been triggered before you stop breathing, which is what determines your next birth, and you can see it coming because your mind gets more subtle. But itself, when your mind is virtuous, death actually is blissful. Are you communicating? I'm telling you the Buddhist view, the explanation, the experience, and the explanation the way the Buddhists describe it, Tibetan Buddhist, the Vajrayana Buddhist. Did you hear that or not?
I heard what you said.
I'm asking you to believe it, I'm just telling you.
Yeah, what about managing the pain of illness?
Yeah, that's a different discussion. Okay. But even then, as the mind gets more subtle, the pain gets less because you're not feeling the senses so strongly. That's why to be in an environment where you can manage the pain, where you can make them peaceful, their mind peaceful. Because we confuse, I think, the physical pain and the mental anguish. I don't know if you agree with that, the gentleman with the beard. You talked about how...
can separate the two.
No, the Buddhist Buddha says absolutely you can. This is the Buddhist whole point about practice. Buddhist practice about knowing your mind and meditating. You can learn to distinguish the two. You can learn to distinguish. That's the whole Buddhist point. But it's got to be a lifetime practice, you know. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not an easy one. Yeah. But in our view, it tends to be seen as the same, equated as the same, you know. Do you understand? I mean, I remember one time... one day in California, I went to two dying people on the same day. I don't go to many dying people. And one was this old lady who was a Zen practitioner. She was like 90, you know, old, deaf. Her husband was Zen practitioner. He was like blind. She was deaf. There was an amazing couple, you know. But you just looked in their faces and they're blissful. She was practically paralyzed. She wasn't, I mean, she has to have been in pain, but her mind was blissful. She was peaceful. And the husband was so sweet. It was the sweetest feeling between them, you know, because she knew what was going on. The other house, this lady, some kind of pain, but it was clear it was her mental. She was beyond distress, completely freaked out, attachment so rampant, didn't know what to think, didn't know who to turn to, didn't know what to do, really out of her mind, so stressful. And this is a very common one for people who are dying. That's why they give them all these televisions, because attachment is so rampant at the time of death, you can cling to anything. You'll cling to anything that's there. It's like you're falling into a black hole. Like I said, you'll hold on to anything. It's so terrifying. That's the torture. That's the nightmare mentally. So this woman, therefore, we all say it, you can't let go, you know? That's what attachment is. It's holding on frantically. And you can hold on for days like this. And you can keep holding on to anything. If your children keep being around you, and your mummy and your dog and your pussy and your music, you'll hold on for days. But it's not, eventually you've got to let go, which makes it even more stressful when you finally have no choice. Whereas if the mind can be, if the room is peaceful, and let's say the Buddhist view, you've got peaceful music and prayers, which you, your mind can go to, but it's peaceful and sweet to hold on to that. It can calm you, you know? And even though your pain, like this woman didn't have much pain, it was more mental anguish. I remember she used to have television the whole time. And then she liked Lama Yeshe, so we decided we'd play a video of Lama Yeshe. And I left, and they tried to get the television to get the videos, and it didn't work. So the television stopped. She died like an hour later, because there was no longer anything for her attachment to hold on to, and it was quiet. Do you understand? A friend of mine who was in a teaching, not a friend, she was in a teaching, we're discussing all this, and I said, and Rinpoche says it, keep the animals out, keep all the troublemakers out, keep all the emotional people out, you know, make it beautiful, peaceful, conducive. Everything there should only be to help the person be peaceful. So she said, she went back home to this person, they were all doing a roster, their friend, and they turned off the Patsy Cline music, they took out the cat, they took out the dog, they took out all the other things, and she died peacefully in like an hour. Which is, I'm not saying it's good to die or not die, but when attachment's so rampant, which brings so much fear, all the other stuff just freaks you out. You know what to do, you know? So it needs to be so managed beautifully with kind people around, no dramas. And also one of my friends who sits with the dying people in the Karuna Hospice, because your mind is getting more subtle and therefore there's much more awareness, the tiniest noise can be beyond distressing. Which is why, even though nurses and doctors are so kind, hospitals are like the worst places to die. Because everything is multiplied, amplified, and there's banging and noises and other people crying and moaning, and really so stressful, you know. So to make it peaceful as much as you can, the pain, but their mind be peaceful and conscious and holding on to you to help them, you know. Do you understand? Make sense? People, we're communicating. And also you can't win, you can't make it perfect. You know, you can't always fix it all. But at least if you know, this is the Buddhist view, the basis of all this, the reasoning behind it, and then do everything you can, you know, and know your role is really powerful. And everybody who helps that person should be educated in the same way. You've got to be aware of where they're at, you know, what's going on, what they like, what they don't like, what's the best for that person. Everything, anyone who's in that room, everything in that room should be for that person's benefit. And just because they're in a coma doesn't mean you all sit there and gossip and rabbit on, you know, or have the room all messy and ugly like sick rooms are sometimes. It's got to be beautiful that whatever they see and hear calms their heart, makes them peaceful, and what should be conducive to them, you know, put imprints in the mind. Understand? Make sense? Yeah.
I was going to add one point to that,
yes.
The difference between pain and suffering, and just even in the medical field, most doctors will openly admit there's a huge difference between pain and suffering.
Mental suffering? Yes,
yeah,
that's
mental
good.
Suffering.
Okay, cool,
we have medications for pain, we have essentially nothing for suffering.
A mental one.
Yeah.
That's right, precisely,
right.
That's the point.
And sometimes we confuse the two, and that's
yes,
when
exactly,
you get,
that's
you get in
that's
trouble.
Yes, exactly, that's the point. That's exactly
yeah.
the point. And that's where the role of the people, and the making the room beautiful, and the people who help. Because when the mental suffering is you don't know who to rely upon. You don't know what to think. You know you're heading to death, and you just don't know what to do. And this can be beyond bearing. So to have a person you can rely on who can make you feel calm and say loving words to you. And one of the things too, which is in the book, but I'll tell it to you know once you are coming back. You know what? Most of us are anxious. Most of us worried. Most of us are guilty. Most of us put ourselves down. Most of us regret the bad things we've done. Now, if you're heading to death, you can only imagine what you're thinking. You're just completely regretting your mistakes. They loom large in your mind. You're so frantic. Just tell your mother, you're the best mother in the world, you know. I love you. You've been the best mother. You've been a good person. This is like nectar to help the person. It's like a miracle of a gift, and it's so easy to do, but we forget these things. So even though she's a complete neurotic mother, tell her she's the best mother in the world, and I thank you so much, and I love you, and I'm sorry I did anything wrong to hurt you. You're a good mother. Make them like feel blissful. That'll calm immediately. We all know what that feels like when someone says one kind word to us. You're living in these ugly old hole people's homes, and people just, you know, I mean, some of them are kind, some people are so kind. One kind person, one kind nurse can be the difference in a person dying well, you know. Just because we know that this is like a miracle, some sweetness and kindness can be so helpful to us when you're sick, when you're desperate, when you're lonely and fearful, you know. It's easy to help. It's easy to help people. And that means we can't panic. We've got to stay steady, you know. Because when you say it's okay, they'll believe you. But if you start panicking, you all drown together, you know, disaster. So it is an important role. It means you've got to be prepared for it, educated. Not like my friend said, I didn't know what to do, you know. She forgot. Or like a friend of mine, it's time to go. A friend of mine in Santa Cruz, the three of them, the family, mummy, daddy's daughter, all Buddhist, all Tibetan Buddhist. And Paul had a really bad heart. He got his wife to promise that if he had a heart attack, please do not touch him. She forgot, panicked, and she called the hospital. What to do, you know? So they came, they took him to hospital, and then we couldn't take him home again, because, you know, that's the rules. So you knew he was distressed, because they had the machines on, keeping him breathing. The daughter knew he didn't want this. He was so distressed, you could see, you know. So we did all the prayers for him that he wanted, and they pulled the plug. So then we couldn't take him home again, because that's what he wanted. We couldn't do it. So they were very sweet at the hospital. They really wrapped him very gently. They put him in the ambulance, drove really slowly to the mortuary. And then we had to negotiate with the mortuary. And you could do this. Rinpoche doesn't say this, but this is what we did. You could easily do this. We had him in the mortuary. We had him all day on the gurney, in the room. We did prayers all day. Then we wanted to stay all night and keep doing prayers for Paul. But they wouldn't let us. They put him in the fridge. So we gave him one of the CDs of the Gyuto monks chanting. And they promised they'd play it in the fridge all night. Now, that, I don't know whether they did or not. I don't know. But they promised they would. So then we came back next day, took him out of the fridge, did more practices. And then we did the cremation, you know. So you can negotiate with the mortuary or the hospital. You can do things. Do you understand? And the key one again, hang on, oh, yes, sweetheart, you have a question, yes.
One quick question.
Yes, go.
I just want to make an observation.
Yes.
For 10 years, I worked in the world's largest transplant center.
Oh, thank you, very good. Tell me about it, I'd love to know.
Well, the one thing that I noticed, because I was not in the medical part, I was in the office part supporting them.
Yes.
And they were a tortured lot. And I kept saying...
What do you mean? Say more. That's very fascinating. Say more.
The physicians and the staff were not balanced people. They were all tortured. And I kept...
What do you mean by tortured, darling?
They lived hard. They suffered greatly. I created an atmosphere in my office with fish and quiet music, and they would come like flies.
Really? How interesting.
Just to try to calm down. I kept trying to explain to them that in a transplant, it's a tragedy that has happened to be eligible to be a transplant patient, and I felt that there was like a stickiness around them of unresolved things. That
you mean all the workers, the nurses and doctors?
Right.
Wow.
Right. So
okay.
I'm just saying that, you know, you have to pray for them.
Okay.
And then I always worried about the organ itself.
Yes, I understand.
That was transplanted because, you know, would it have a negative karma attached because the person was not resolved when they passed? And so, you know, there's like a second generation of karmic seeds that I always
wondered
about.
Well, the Buddhist view, that's a very interesting topic, actually, because I hear many people talk about that people who've taken on organs feel the other person's, this kind of thing, take on their characteristics. The only way I can explain that karmically is this. May I give you the Buddhist view, a possible suggestion of this one? I remember even one time Lama Zopa Rinpoche saying, and you can believe this or not, I don't care, I'm just telling you, that even a bone that's 1,000 years old, because of a connection between the person whose body that was 1,000 years ago, there's some kind of connection there. And then secondly, because of the power of mantra, for example, just saying mantra, blessing your breath, blowing on the bone, the consciousness, even wherever it is 1,000 years later, would get the benefit. Now, you can believe that sounds pretty cosmic. So it shows there's some connection. So it seems to me, it must be pretty intense connection. Your beating heart, given somebody else's body, that's a pretty intense connection to have between two people. There must be very strong karma there between those two consciousnesses. The heart itself, in Buddhist view, doesn't have a consciousness, but it's the body of a person who was a real person. So it's not surprising that a person whose heart it is now can have those types of experiences. But the Buddhist view would be the heart itself is physical. That's got nothing to do with the consciousness. But because of the connection between that being whose heart it was and that heart is quite strong. And therefore, for another person, you know, for a baby to go to a mother's womb, that's a pretty intense connection, isn't it? That you run like a magnet to a mummy's womb. Well, it seems to me pretty similar. A person's heart is keeping my body alive. That's a powerful connection between us from whichever lives in the past. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's kind of interesting. It is interesting, isn't it?
Thank
That's
you.
That's very interesting. Thank you. You know, it's 10 to 9. Time to go home? Yeah? What do you think?
Yeah.
So we do more on the weekend, and then those who want the book, you can get the book if you like. Up to you. Whatever.
Venerable Rabina, could I just ask one quick question?
Where are you? Yes, Joan. Just Joan.
One quick question.
Yeah.
What about the concept of thinking of organ donation as an act of bodhicitta?
Of course it is. No question. As Martin from Lama Zopa says, it's amazing compassion. Of course it is. But so then what? Finish the sentence.
No, I'm just curious.
No, but then continue with that. Then?
Well, an act of bodhicitta.
It is, of that person. Amazing. To want to give their heart. But then?
Yes.
Like I said to you, the other Lama said.
Right, the karmic connection.
Pardon?
The karmic connection between you and others you were just saying.
Huh? I'm missing you, Joan.
No, I just
is it a question or a point?
No, it was a question.
So what's the question?
The question is, what are your thoughts on organ donation as an act of bodhicitta?
Well, it is that. There's no doubt about it. I don't doubt that for a second.
Okay.
But all Lama Zopa is saying is, all the other Lama, I couldn't put into this book, because it's not this other Lama's book. As he said, let's say I decide 20 years ago, I'm going to give my organs. Amazing. Right there, powerful imprints in my mind. You agree? That's what, you know, compassion. But let's say I spend the next 20 years being an old drunk and killing people. Honey, I'm not so sure that motivation is going to be getting a top dog when I die. So it doesn't follow. Unless before you died, you delight and rejoice that your organs are going to be given to somebody. So it's you know, you understand, it's a tricky one. Of course, it's all the lamas, as Rinpoche says in the book, how marvelous, you know. Of course, it's extraordinary, the karma you create when you thought of giving your organs. It's amazing, there's no doubt. But these other aspects are also, it's a dangerous thing if the person has got the karma. It's like killing a person. There's other things as well. But there's no doubt about that, yeah. Of course there is. Yeah. Is that a hand? No. We're done then. Yes?
I have something kind of...
Okay, give her the mic.
Yes,
okay. Yes, sweetheart.
I was just thinking about the same thing. If someone has achieved bodhicitta, we've decided that with their
organ... Okay, hang on, wait. You actually achieved bodhicitta.
Oh, well.
That's different.
Okay, yeah. Bodhisattva, this does not apply.
There's another kettle of fish, sweetheart. You can't ask us. They can do what they'd like. They can cut their organs out now and not harm them. So that's different.
Okay, so we haven't got there yet, but we've got a lot of compassion. And we know that when they get to the point that the organ donation, we are no longer feeling physical pain. So we're worried about the subtle consciousness seeing what's happening to the body and being upset.
Rinpoche's key point is, and the point I was trying to make, that was my added point. The key point is, until the consciousness has actually left the body, you can't guarantee the person is dead yet, because they can come back to life. And
okay.
That's his point as well. That's
all right.
The point.
I was
that's
just wondering if
point.
You could be, your consciousness could be actually happy.
That's not the problem.
Okay.
Could easily be. That's not the issue. The issue is, until the consciousness has seemed to be left the body, and there are various ways to prove that, you can't be certain the person is dead yet.
All right. Sorry,
that's
I was thinking of the high...
I know what you're thinking, and there's no contradiction.
The fiery hells of Avicii you're supposed to give yourself to help another sentient being, we just said in puja today, so you should kind of...
Why are you saying that here?
Because it reminded me of it.
I know, but is there a question from that, or you just want to say it? How's it helping us?
Never mind.
No, don't say that, darling. I'm not trying to be mean to you. I'm asking you why you're telling us
I'm
that.
I'm just wondering if having that state of mind could be helpful and help counteract the fact
Which state
that you're
of
being...
Mind?
So when you're being sliced open, if you have practiced enough and had practiced up enough to that
no
time...
No problem.
That you
if
can, you,
honey, if you've practiced enough, there's no problem. Give your organs before you stop breathing. No problem, baby. The great bodhisattvas do. As Trinity Sanchar Rinpoche quoted, one great bodhisattva, whatever level, I don't know, they're beyond ego already, he says the action of cutting off his hand and feeding it to a starving animal is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. So go for it, babies. That's where you're at. We're just looking at the different dangers because we're not sure the person is actually dead. That's the problem.
Okay.
That's the point. Do you see? Yeah. But all your points, wonderful.
May I read the dedication?
Yep, read the dedication.
You're done?
Okay. Go for it.
Okay. All right.
Explain whose dedications they are and why they're giving it.
Okay.
People don't know these things.
These dedications are from Annie Hassel and Louise Miller, and the reason that they are
giving these dedications
is because they're sponsoring the teachings tonight.
And that means
that...
Sorry, so tell people. Tell people
are
new here.
Because the, all of the teachings and everything that goes on in the center, the utilities, the rent, and so forth, are all on paid on a volunteer basis. And unless someone like Annie and Louise pay for the sponsorship, then we can't afford to have invite teachers to come.
Because all the what she's saying is all the teachings are free.
Right, and we
That's right.
And we want
so
to ensure
hint,
that
hint.
Anyone that the teachings will be.
I can say that they can't.
So the teaching will be available to anyone, whether they are you know, able to come and pay or not pay or whatever. So that's why the teachings are all given on a
free. That's it.
So these.
It's not many centers are like this, I promise you.
So these two sponsors are just sponsoring the teachings, and so we still have the element of the rest of, you know, the center being here, the rent and the lights and the water and the
flushing
the toilets
and
so forth.
And get you some
for
salary and the mortgage.
Right. And so if you would like to contribute to that at any time?
I wasn't meant to be doing that. I'm being stupid as usual, okay? Okay. So done.
And we're one of the few centers.
Yeah, you're one of, I tell you, you're one of the very few on this earth. So apart from the Chinese, they're just naturally generous. They're amazing, you know. Even one of my Christian friends says the only ones who give money in their church are the Chinese. Well, the Vietnamese as well. The Asians.
Yeah.
We Americans and Australians, as long as we get something for our money, we're not happy to give, you know. That's why I say they should have a shop here, because we all love spending money. We don't mind giving the bit on the end, you know. It's called a donation. But it's called profit, and we don't mind giving profit. We wouldn't say to Starbucks, give me back my profit. I'll pay for the costs only. We don't say that, do we? Because we don't mind commerce, you see. Anyway, I better shut up. I'm getting a bit troublemaker.
So we thank Annie Annie Hassel for our families to find happiness and the causes of happiness, good health and well-being, and to be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Louise Miller, to the long lives of our precious teachers.
That'll do. No more prayers. Enough for tonight. Good night. I'll see you tomorrow. All being well, if we don't die, okay? Thank you. Good night, everybody.